Now, as promised, we turn to Jill Bevilacqua's program, Vatican Centuries, for a look at how the Vatican evolved from a very small and persecuted Christian community in Imperial Rome into the center of a universal church with more than 1 billion members worldwide. Today, we go back to the time of Rome's Emperor Nero, whose persecution of the Christians actually helped to found the newborn church.
Chapter 2, The Stage.
The centuries slip by, and the great Roman Republic is but a distant dream.
The golden age of Augustus already belongs to yesterday, and the empire is in the hands of his relations, a poor set of individuals who follow their own interests and leave the empire to take care of itself.
By now, however, it is so big and its government so well organized that even this succession of decadent rulers fails to destroy it.
The old-time religion is beginning to lose its hold, and there are rumors of an event in far-off Palestine.
A new religion, founded on love, is having an extraordinary success there.
In no time at all, it has reached Rome, and it's soon clear that the very existence of the empire is threatened.
By the imperial period, the Vatican had developed from an agricultural area into a kind of pleasure ground. Apart from farms, there were gardens adorned with monuments, the villas of well-known Roman families, and a number of temples.
Like all the roads leading out of Rome, the road from the Tiber to the Vatican, the Via Cornelia, was bordered by tombs. Close to this road, on the slopes of the Vatican Hill, where it rises gently from the river, were the famous gardens planted by Agrippina the Elder, mother of the Emperor Caligula. Part of this estate verged onto the cemetery. The gardens enclosed a portico on the riverside and a circus or racecourse, which was begun by Caligula and finished by Nero, who added marble steps and an obelisk.
In the course of time, the gardens became crown property and were a favorite resort of the young emperors Caligula, Nero, and much later, of Heliogabalus. These playboy emperors used the course to drive four-horse racing chariots.
But when Heliogabalus decided to bring in elephants harnessed to chariots, he ordered that the course be enlarged. And as the hillside cemetery was so close to the circus, some of the wayside graves had to be demolished.
But the Vatican Circus has for us much more sinister connotations. Far from the romantic picture of pleasure gardens and chariot racing, it is as the scene of the first great persecution of the Christians that this site has won its place in history. The Vatican Circus is a place where Christian and pagan graves are forever mingled.
It was about the year 64 AD that the Vatican became truly a sacred place, consecrated once and for all with the blood of the early Christian martyrs, among whom, we are told, were St. Peter and St. Paul.
Let us go back a decade, to the year 54 AD, just 40 years after the death of Augustus. The old-time Roman religion is dead, but superstition is still rife. And now, one of the most extraordinary characters ever to appear on the imperial scene makes his entrance.
Nero Claudius Caesar Drusus Germanicus was born in Antium in the year 37 AD. He probably never knew his father, but his mother, Agrippina the Younger, had great plans for him. Having married her uncle, the aging Emperor Claudius, she persuaded him to name Nero his successor, and then promptly poisoned him. It was the year 54 AD. Nero was 17.
The first 5 years of his reign were very promising, thanks to the careful government of Seneca the philosopher, who was his tutor, and Burrus, the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. But then the young man decided it was time he threw off the reins and showed the Romans what stuff he was made of.
In If we are to judge Nero by the cold facts, we're bound to conclude that he was an arch-villain. His mother had connived successfully to get him the throne when it should have gone to Britannicus, son of Claudius. But Nero wanted to make sure of his supremacy, so in 55 he had Britannicus poisoned. 4 years later, he tried to drown his mother, and then had her murdered. In 62, he repudiated his wife Octavia, and later had her murdered. His second wife, Poppaea, died from a kick in the stomach, said to have been inflicted by Nero in a bad mood.
But it was in the year 64 that something happened which gave Nero a place in history that no one has ever tried to take from him. On a hot, moonlit night in July, the city of Rome went up in flames. Nero's reputation was already so infamous that the populace immediately suspected him. He tried to allay suspicion by giving refuge to the homeless, offering space and material for the building of temporary shelters, reducing the price of grain, and having supplies of food brought from Ostia and the neighboring towns. But to no avail. It was rumored that he had planned it all so that he could build a new and sumptuous house over the ruins.
It was then that Nero decided to direct the accusations elsewhere. Tacitus takes up the story.
To get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite torture on a class hated for their abominations called the Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus. And a most mischievous superstition thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, the arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle, and was exhibiting a show in the circus, while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer, or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not, as it seemed, for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty, that they were being destroyed.
By all normal standards, Nero was one of the most fiendish human beings who ever existed. But if we try to see him the way he saw himself, a different man emerges. For Nero, the world was a great stage, and he was the leading man in the non-stop Roman epic. He was the first actor-manager, born 2,000 years before his time. How he would have loved to see his name in lights! Throughout his reign, Nero appeared frequently in public as singer, actor, and charioteer. He dabbled in painting and fancied himself as a poet. And when he was dying, he spoke the famous lines, "What an artist the world is losing."
But Nero made one disastrous mistake. When he put the blame for the fire of Rome on the Christians and sent them to their deaths, it was the end of his stage career. For the chief actors in this drama were martyrs, and they took over the show for all time. Beside their real-life heroism, Nero's antics are those of a lifeless puppet, dangling sadly in the wings.
And tune in again next Saturday and Sunday at the very same times for part 3 of Jill Bevilacqua's program, Vatican Centuries. Join us again then.